Y'all, we have a problem because I was just listening to Smartless, their interview with Matthew McConaughey, which means I might have his accent and way of speaking stuck in my head because I tend to echo people even when I shouldn't. And anyways, all right, all right, all right.
All right, all right, all right. I say all right, all right, all right.
Was that good? Damn. Matthew, we're not friends, but could we be? Because I would just like to record you speaking. I could listen to him forever. And he's not even the point of this episode. We're not doing a Matthew McConaughey movie. We're doing a Mike Myers movie. So I married an axe murderer. Cue the music. All right, all right, all right. Sorry, Matthew. All right, we got to play a clip or something of So I Married an Axe Murderer because I got to get Matthew out of my head a little bit here. If I don't, I'm going to have a hard time channeling Mike Myers, and we need to channel the Micah Myers. All right, all right, all right. Damn it. I need to make myself stop saying that. Let me just find the trailer to So I Married an Ex-Murderer real right quick. Crick? Sure.
Not Buffy phone, YouTube.
Oh, it's playing the ads. We gotta wait. What is this at? What is this for? I don't even know what this is. Stars? I don't watch Stars. Is that a channel? I sound old. I'm not a boomer. I'm a millennial. It's in the title. I'm also not from the South. And this is also not me making fun of Southern accents. I just, like we, I tried to establish. How do I skip the rest of this Stars ad? Does it not let me? YouTube, tell me how to function ya. I don't know if my tendency to pick up on accents or just the cadence of certain things or a saying is considered echolalia. I'd have to look that up a little bit more, and I'm not going to right now. But I've done this all my life, and sometimes it gets me in trouble, and sometimes it gets me a laugh. Jesus Christ, this just, I want the trailer. How do I skip you?
Hi, my name is Mike Myers. Perhaps you recognize me from my recent motion picture, Wayne's World.
Thanks, thanks. As you can see, I'm on the set of my new film in which I play a young fellow named Charlie, who gets a little more than he bargained for. For example, there's suspense.
Have you heard of this case?
Mrs. X. She murders her husband on her honeymoon, then she changes her identity and marries again.
I never heard of it, so what?
I think I'm dating Mrs. X.
The Justice Department reports an alarming rise in the number of poisoning murders across the United States.
It's a smart drink to improve your brain power. You like it, Charlie?
Thank you, no.
There's action.
Charlie, there's something I've been meaning to tell you.
She's a killer.
Charlie, she is not a killer.
And of course, there's plenty of romance.
What do you look for in a girl you date?
I know everyone always says sense of humor, but I'd really have to go with breast size.
You're lying on your side, totally asleep. You could just, stick a needle in.
So, as you can see, it has all the elements of a truly great motion picture. Oh, did I mention the axe murder?
Hello, sweetheart.
Missed me, darling?
Tell me that wasn't a Dr. Evil laugh. Y'all, I love this movie. I loved it since the first time I saw it, way back, I don't know when, because I was a bebe, not a baby. This came out in 93. I was a wee bebe of a person. All right, now our second problem is Mike Myers likes to do the Scottish accent, and he's supposed to be of Scottish descent in this movie. That's not good. Scottish in this movie. He also plays his dad, Stuart, in the film. We see him do in his comedy I feel like somewhat often, especially in Austin Powers, playing multiple characters. I'm convinced that his dad, Stuart, birthed Fat Bastard, at least. Like, Fat Bastard had to have come from his ballsack. Definitely a Scottish semen. And I do mean semen as in ejaculation. I don't like that word.
Ejaculate.
I don't know how I'm going to keep myself on track today. This movie makes me so happy. It did not do well when it came out. It wasn't received the way it is. I feel like today it's definitely one of those movies that has gained, I guess, a cult following-ish, however you want to word that, as time has gone on since its original release date. Which, I don't know why. This movie is hilarious. It was originally attached to Woody Allen. I'm definitely glad that that changed. Isn't Woody Allen up? Isn't he one of those guys that was up to some nasty male bullshit? I give it a little goog real quick because I don't want to be wrong on that. Yeah, I was just reading about the allegations against Woody Allen real quick because I actually was not 100% familiar with that and I didn't want to just spout off about something. I didn't at least give it a quick goog. So everything's allegedly, you know, so don't sue me. But yeah, this film was originally tied to Woody Allen. And from what I just read, he's been accused by his stepdaughter of sexually molesting her at or starting at the age of 7. And he's denied these claims. So again, he allegedly did this. But I believe victims until there's proof that it didn't happen. And if you don't like that, it's another conversation. So that's not what we're here for, though. I just, you know, spouting off. So I'm really glad that this movie fell into the hands of Mike Myers. He changed a lot of the original script. He wanted to make it more comedy. I think it was supposed to originally be a little bit more of a darker thriller. And he wanted to lean more on the comedy part of the dark horror, dark comedy, not dark horror, dark comedy. I wasn't planning on talking about Woody Allen, so now I feel thrown by myself. I wasn't even going to include it, but it just came out. I mean, it is an interesting fact, but anyways, let's jump into this a little bit more. I'm going to give you some movie facts per use, and then I'm going to go into a smidge of history on beat poetry because it's a huge part of this film. It's at its core. I think it's fascinating. If you're not here for it, you know, skip forward to I don't know when. But it is interesting, and I promise I'm not going to go into a lengthy history of it. I feel like I always say that, and then I end up talking more than I planned on. Have we lost Matthew yet? Is he out of my brain? I mean, I just popped him back in there, so maybe I shouldn't have said that. But I think Mike is here along with some Austin Powers and Fat Bastard. So here we go.
Get in my belly!
So I Married an Axe Murderer. It came out in 1993. It's a romantic, dark comedy film. Our main character, Charlie McKenzie, he's a man afraid of commitment until he meets Harriet Travis, who works at a butcher shop and who may or may not allegedly be a serial killer. It was directed by Thomas Schlamm. I looked that up. I put the link next to the name, so I hope I got it right. It was written by Robbie Fox and produced by Robert N. Fried and Carrie Woods. Our cast. I don't usually give off the names of the cast later, but it's written in my notes this way, so here we go. Like I already said, Mike Myers is our main character, Charlie McKenzie, and he also plays Stuart McKenzie, his dad. Nancy Travis plays Harriet Michaels. I don't know why I put Harriet Travis in my little synopsis there, so sorry, I got the last name switched up of the actress and character. So the character's name is Harriet Michaels, the actress is Nancy Travis, sorry. Anthony LaPaglia plays Tony Gardino. I am part Italian, so I feel like I should be able to say these, but I'm also, as I've said a million times, insanely dyslexic, and I just, my brain don't get along with a lot of words. Amanda Plummer plays Rose Michaels. Michael Richards. Who the fuck is Michael Richards and who the fuck is the insensitive man? Why did I put this on the cast list? I don't know. I don't remember that character. Moving on. Brenda Fricker plays Mae McKenzie, Charlie's mom. Matt Doherty plays William Head McKenzie, his little brother. That'll make more sense in a little bit. The head nickname part. Charles Grodin plays our commandeered driver. Also will make more sense in a little bit. Phil Hartman, he makes an appearance as John Vicky Johnson, an Alcatraz guide. Alan Arkin plays Tony's boss. Debbie Mazar plays Susan, Tony's girlfriend. Stephen Wright plays a pilot. And Greg German plays a hotel concierge. So a lot of these people, if you don't recognize them, that's okay. I tend to recognize people by their face and not their name. And even then, sometimes I'll forget. For example, Charles Grodin, Phil Hartman, Greg German, Debbie Mazar, Stephen Wright, they are actors and comedians, but their characters are a little bit more of cameos because they're not in the film a whole lot. They're just, you know, snippets here and there. But they wanted to specifically work on this film to work with Mike Myers. So at the time, Mike Myers, he was gaining popularity on SNL, and Wayne's World had just come out prior to the filming and release of this. So Mike Myers, he was on the rise. Oh, and I also wanted to note Marla Sokoloff. I'm sorry if I mispronounced her last name. I didn't put the pronunciation in my notes, and I should have. I didn't even notice this, but when I was looking up shit for the film, the name actually sounded a little bit familiar to me, which I was surprised with myself because, like I just said, I can be real bad with names. But she is in she doesn't have a speaking role, but she is an extra in the Alcatraz scene. So she's a visitor. She's on the tour. But she's known for playing Lucy Hatcher on the legal drama television series The Practice, and Gia Mahan on Full House and Fuller House. She also has appeared in films like True Crime, came out in 96, Dude, Where's My Car, 2000, Sugar and Spice, 2001. I like that movie. Love on the Side, 2004. And she actually was the original actress set to play Topanga Lawrence on ABC's Boy Meets World and had even filmed a few scenes, but ultimately she was replaced. I'm not sure why. I didn't look it up that much. With Danielle Fishburne, Fishnell? Shoot, I'm sorry, I'm getting her name wrong. But yeah, so I just wanted to mention that real quick because I was like, oh shit, I definitely remember her from especially movies like Dude, Where's My Car, because I was real into that movie when it came out, as well as Sugar and Spice. That's a movie I definitely want to do, I want to cover someday. If you don't know those references, sorry, but here we are anyway. So the script that eventually became So I Married an Murderer. It was originally titled The Man Who Cried Wife. I really enjoy both of these titles. Listen, one of the things when I was in school for my degree, I have my degree. God, you wouldn't be able to tell the way I speak sometimes. I have my degree in English literature. I'm real good at giving like a solid fucking title. Okay, my writing skills expand beyond that. However, for a piece of writing, movie, TV show, whatever, the title is very important because that's your hook, okay? So if you got a shit title and your body of work is amazing, but the title shit, I mean, a lot of people might be missing out on viewing a masterpiece. So your title is essential, I believe, to the success of something. And I'm real good at coming up with a title. And I really enjoy both of these titles so much. They're a good ass hook. Do I like So I Married an Axe Murderer better? Yes. But I also like The Man Who Cried Wife because that could be so many things, you know? Like I was kind of saying before, Mike Myers heavily rewrote the script to suit his own comedic sensibilities. I think it's brilliant. The director, they had some beef. There's interviews years later after the movie came out talking about the animosity between them. Mike was pushing for more comedic. The director was pushing for less comedic. And, you know, they have their feelings about the whole thing, even years later. Some other people that were considered for the role of Charlie, besides that bitch Woody Allen, allegedly, still a bitch, whatever, was Chevy Chase, Albert Brooks, and Martin Short, who I'm not as familiar with Albert Brooks, but I'm a Chevy Chase fan. We all know, if you listen to the My Father of the Bride episode, we all know that I love and adore Martin Short. I wish I could just hug him and thank him for his presence in entertainment and the comfort it has been for me. But anyways, I don't think they would have been right for the role of Charlie. I think that Mike Myers brought something real special to this role that only he could have brought. Yeah, definitely wasn't a miscast there with Mr. Myers. Sharon Stone was initially set to play Harriet Michaels, the supposed axe murderer of the film. I do kind of think that was a missed opportunity. I think Sharon Stone would have been real good here because I don't want to give it away just yet. But having Sharon Stone play Harriet Michaels, who, you know, might be an axe murderer, I think that she would have brought a little something more to the I might be an axe murderer part than Nancy Travis, who smashed the role. She does a fantastic fucking job in this role. She really does. However, there's just something about Sharon Stone that makes you question things more. Her ability to play that kind of, am I a femme fatale? Am I not? But also, like Myers, who he plays two roles in the film, Sharon Stone wanted to play both Harriet and Rose, Rose being her sister, who is played by Amanda Plummer, who, again, Amanda Plummer does a fantastic fucking job on that role. I just think that would have been, that could have been really, really good. I don't even know, I don't have any other words to describe that besides I think that could have been really fucking interesting. But the studio execs, those bitches, whoever they are, were at Sony, they didn't like the idea of Sharon Stone playing both roles. So because of that, she turned down the part. She was like, well, unless I can do both, I don't want to do it. And God, I wish they had entertained that more. I know everything revolves around money, but even just doing some sort of screen test to kind of see, get that visual, I don't know. I feel like that could have... Oh, that could have been so good. So this film is set in San Francisco, and there is a lot of stuff out there that talks about how it is definitely one of those films that is a great highlight and visual time capsule of San Francisco in the 90s, especially the early 90s, because it shows you all of these iconic locations and just San Francisco in the 90s. It's almost like we get to experience that a little bit, even though I was never part of that experience. I was born in 90, but I wasn't born in San Francisco. And I surely wouldn't have been an adult in the 90s in San Francisco at the time, which I just think that there is a big difference between experiencing something as a child and then as an adult. So regardless, it is such a treat and an experience to even just see San Francisco the way you see it in this film. And I would recommend it just for that in itself. So one of my favorite filming locations where Charlie and Harriet spend their honeymoon, the first night as a man and wife, is the Poets Corner Hotel. In real life, this scene was filmed at the Dunsmuir Estate in Oakland, California. And I would love to visit there because I'll just have to post photos, maybe do a little house tour like I did with What Lies Beneath. I also was wanting to do a house tour of Father of the Bride. So maybe we'll have some fun with that and just do a back-to-back, I don't know, long form video. I don't know. But yeah, I just wanted to highlight that because it is one of my favorite locations. As I was researching this movie, before we get into the beat poetry history, and I was reading about, you know, how it's again, this kind of time capsule for a visual medium of San Francisco in the 90s, I was learning about some of the extras and the process of casting extras and really wanting to highlight the diversity of the 90s. Of the 90s, of San Francisco in the 90s. So I wanted to talk a little bit about an iconic film extra that does actually have a speaking role. He's the only extra in this movie that has a speaking role, but he is iconic within himself, especially with the writers and the actors strike going on. These roles, these extras, bit actors, I'm not using the correct terms. I don't know why I said bit actor, but I did. Anyways, are so essential to the entire body of what filmmaking is. And without these people, you'd only have parts of a film. They're so important. They deserve what they're worth, and they're worth so much more than a lot of studios and execs give them credit for. Davia Nelson, she worked on So I Married an Axe Murderer as the local casting director. The director, didn't tell her who exactly to cast for each scene or the look of the background characters, like other directors typically do. But what he did say was he wanted San Francisco captured. So in the movie, Harriet. She is a butcher and she has her own butcher shop. And the butcher shop they used was a real butcher shop that is still standing today in San Francisco, but now it's a pizza parlor. I'll probably post some photos of the iconic history of this location itself. But that specific area was such a melting pot of diversity, and I'm sure still is today, but I'm not familiar with, you know, the history of San Francisco like that. One of the extras you see at the butcher shop where Charlie meets Harriet, so one of those extras, Albert Nalbandian. He is iconic within himself. He was a local prolific character actor at the time. I think that's what I was trying to say before, character actor, not bit actor. I'm not sure if the terms can be related or not, but anyways. So he has, like I already said, the only speaking line as one of the extras in the film. He interrupts Mike Myers' character, Charlie, and Harriet as they're kind of flirting over the counter. It's very busy in the butcher shop at the time when this is happening. So I love this interaction. It definitely stands out because the way he gives his line, I don't know, it's almost like he's just playing himself. Maybe he's just playing a San Franciscan. I don't know if that's how you say that, but here we are. So Nalbandian, he ran a flower stand for 70 years outside of the Macy's in Union Square, but he also devoted a chunk of his time to acting, and he became a favorite actor for Francis Ford Coppola and George Lucas. He appeared in American Graffiti, Peggy Sue Got Married, Jack with Robin Williams. Oh my God, that movie, you guys, that's definitely another movie I'm going to do sometime. And that was among other films that were shot locally. So he has 20 films to his credit, and Davia Nelson, the local casting director for this movie, she remembered him well and cast him in films she worked on with Francis Ford Coppola in the future. So in an interview, Davia Nelson said he just brought with him sort of this just beauty and kindness. And Francis adored him. Francis just really admired and adored Al. And the minute we started on a movie with Coppola, he'd say, well, let's find something for Al. Francis always wanted Al to be a part of things. End quote. I just thought that was really special and important to point out because these, I guess, smaller scale actors are so important to the entire industry and they deserve their flowers. So Nalbandian, he passed away at the age of 95 in 2017. I don't know the full story of his life, but he sounds like such a special person. And I just had to talk about him a little bit. So let's go into some quick facts about beat poetry. I really wanted to try to do my own beat poem for this episode, but I got a little too self-conscious and I don't know if that's within my capabilities, so it's not happening. But I thought about it, I considered it, if that counts for anything. Maybe if I got the beat enough in my head, I could come up with something. But all right, so what the fuck is beat poetry? Let's get into it. In the 1940s and 50s, a new generation of poets rebelled against the conventions of mainstream American life and writing. They became known as the beat poets, a name that evokes weariness, down and outness, the beat under a piece of music, and a beatific spirituality. At first, they organized in New York City and then Los Angeles and then eventually San Francisco. By the 1950s, poets at the heart of the movement had settled in the Bay Area, especially in neighborhoods near beat poet and publisher Lawrence. All right, all right, all right. Matthew's still here, guys. Are we surprised? Nope. This is definitely an Italian last name. I'm so here for it. Ferlinghetti. Okay, I feel like I should have been able to get that, but, you know, here we are. Lawrence Ferlinghetti's bookstore, City Lights. The beat poets were interested in challenging mainstream culture and conventional writing styles and techniques. They used free verse, which is a non-metrical, non-rhyming lines that closely follow the natural rhythms of speech. That was the preferred form for the beat poets. Favorite topics? Transgression, obscenity, alienation, which really isn't surprising given that the center of their movement was about breaking mainstream culture. Jazz. I love jazz. You guys. Okay, quick side note. In a couple of weeks, a little less than a couple of weeks, I am finally going to get to see my queen, my heart, my soul. Okay, more, she's not. I am my heart and my soul, but she's a part of it. Lady Gaga. Sing jazz and play the piano at her Las Vegas residency. I love her so fucking much. I love all of her music, but specifically getting to see her sing jazz and play the piano has been a dream of mine for a very long time. Her music is so important to me. When I really started getting into listening to her, it was in 2017. Her record, Joanne, quite literally saved my life. Her music helped guide me away from a very, very dark place that was tempting me to take my own life. And I know I get really heavily into the adoration of people I don't know, you know, that being celebrities and such, people in the spotlight. But I truly admire her art, and I'm so thankful for her sharing that with the world. And if I ever had a chance to meet her, I would just want to say thank you. You know, I've seen interviews of her talking about the adoration that people have for her. And she's like, I'm not some goddess that dropped from the heavens. I'm not perfect. I'm real. I'm human. I live a very human experience. And that just resonates with me, because I know that it's dangerous to put people, celebrity or not, on a pedestal, because it has the potential to blind you to the harm that humans are capable of inflicting on one another, and ignoring things that are a very real problem. But anyways, I'm sorry, now I'm going off on a whole other thing, but I just had to share that I cannot believe that I finally get to see her sing live, and I get to see her sing jazz. That's where she fucking shines, my dudes. So anyways, jazz was a major influence on the Beat Poets. Its improvisation and rhythmic qualities match up well with their own musical use of free verse. They were also often inspired by Buddhism, hallucinogenic drugs, of course, and higher consciousness. They were political poets. Many were interested in the idea of anarchy. Fuck yes. They also employed cross-cultural ideas in both their poetry and their political views. Jack Kerouac is said to have coined the term beat generation when describing the down and out status of himself and his peers during the post-war years. Some famous beat poets are Allen Ginsberg. He is undoubtedly one of the most well-known and prominent of the beat poets. His 112-line poem, Howl, was considered obscene at the time, which led to the rest of its publisher, Lawrence Ferlinghetti. The case actually went to trial, but eventually Howl, again, the poem, triumphed its challenge to the obscenity of laws in the day. It ended up a sort of manifesto for beat poets. Additionally, Ferlinghetti is famous for starting the City Lights Bookshops, like we mentioned above, magazine and publishing company, which became known as the heart of the beat movement. He is also the author of more than 30 books of poetry. All right. All right, all right, all right. Thanks, Matthew. We have landed at the movie. Here we go. Opening scene, aerial views of San Francisco. You gotta love it. And the song, There She Goes Again, is playing. So I guess Mike Myers was obsessed, maybe still is, obsessed with this song. And they use it a lot in this film as a sort of like transition between scenes, whatever. So you're going to hear that if you watch it, because I'm not going to keep playing it. But you're going to hear that if you watch it a lot. I mean, it is a good ass song, but it did stand out to me before I even looked up facts about this movie, that I was like, damn, it's a good song. But, you know, I like a little change. I like a little switch up. Plus, I mean, it's a pretty great soundtrack. So I just, you know, feel like there could have been a little bit more variety, especially of really good classic 90s coffee shop grunge, jazzy, whatever music that they could have used besides There She Goes Again. But anyways, so we kind of zoom into this very 90s coffee shop, urban, brick, quirky San Fran beat poet spot. The camera angle, when it lands on the step at the front door of this location, it kind of goes into this POV camera angle, as if the camera is just a person walking around with the camera on their face, you know, POV. Not talking about porn, I swear, but here we are. So yeah, it's kind of the POV camera angle of what must be an employee, because we see this big old pond-sized coffee cup being washed for 0.2 seconds with a sponge. I really need to burn. I got a thing about sponges. Personally, I got a couple silicone sponges that I fucking love. They're easy to wash. You can throw them in the dishwasher when you need to. I don't like sponges. I don't like bristles. To me, they just look like they're covered in germs constantly, and I can't stand it. Anyways, Sponges are nasty. It's so barf is what I put in my notes. Then the cup being dried again for like 0.2 seconds. Filled and foam topped before being brought to our main character, Charlie. This badonkadonk of a fucking mug is sort of floating at the bottom edge of the screen with the foam and the coffee, you know, jiggling around, foaming your face before it's handed off to Charlie. It's a cool camera angle. It just kind of makes me giggle at the same
time.
Excuse
me, miss. There seems to be a mistake. I believe I ordered the large cappuccino. Hello! Look at the size of this thing.
It's practically a bowl.
It's like Campbell's cappuccino. My size. Please. Aidez-moi.
So he's chatting up his friend Tony, who is there as an undercover cop, dressed like...
You look like Huggy Bear from Starsky and Hutch.
What do you mean? I look hip.
No. You look like an undercover cop trying to look hip.
I am an undercover cop trying to look hip.
And they're talking about Charlie's last relationship and then relationships. He just broke up with someone and Tony's kind of getting on him for breaking up with women for weird reasons, like smelling like soup.
Every time you meet a nice girl that you can get close to, you come up with some paranoid reason why you should break up with her.
That's not true. I broke up with those girls for very good reasons.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Really? What about Jill?
She was in the mafia.
She was in the mafia?
Yes, the Cosa Nostra. The whole time we went out, she didn't tell me what she did for a living.
Charlie, she was unemployed. She didn't have a job.
Well, that's just a perfect cover now, isn't it?
All right. What about Pam?
She smelled like soup.
Mike is a beat poet. He seemingly makes his living off being a beat poet. Like, is that possible? Are you making bank off that? Yeah, Mike... Not Mike. Charlie, he's a beat poet. And he's about to perform. So he's introduced by a dude who... Guys, he looks like fucking Carrot Top. He's not. I looked it up. I don't even know when Carrot Top became a thing. But it's not. It just happens to look like him. And it's Charlie's time to perform.
Woman! Whoa! Man! Whoa! Man! She was a thief. You gotta believe she stole my heart and my cat. Betty, Judy, Josie, and those hot pussy cats. They make me horny Saturday morning. Girls of cartoons won't leave me in ruins. I want to be Betty's Barney. Hey, Jane, get me off this crazy thing called love.
Guys, snaps for Charlie. Don't actually snap. I actually hate the sound of snapping. It makes my ears feel like they're gonna bleed and that I might need to murder something. But anyways, this isn't about me. So there's this screen behind Charlie that's kind of scrolling through different photos as he does his thing. Usually the subject of his poem, typically the woman he's dating or dated. And he's got an unlit cigarette in his hand that he never lights or smokes. He just has it. At the end of his poem, he blows out a little tea light candle. You know, there's a lot of moving pieces to the performance, and I like the little bits of the unlit cigarette that he always has just in his right hand, and then the tea light candle up thing at the end. Very symbolic. Reminds me of one of my favorite episodes of Schitt's Creek where Moira, if you haven't seen Schitt's Creek, this won't make sense, but Moira has gone to some sort of conference with Roland, and this is when she is on the town council, and they end up getting drunk as shit, and she falls asleep in Roland's hotel room. So they think that they've had sex, so now she's kind of swearing off drinking, and at the end of the episode, she's dumping all of the beer in her motel room with John, her husband, down the sink, and he comes in. John comes in. He's like, "What are you doing?" And that's my beer. You don't even drink beer. And she goes, "It's symbolic, John."
Moira, that's my beer. You don't even drink beer.
It's symbolic, John.
I can't do it well, but it's funny as fuck to me. Anyways, back to Charlie and So I Married an Axe Murderer in 93 by Catherine O'Hara. I love ya. So the next day, Charlie, he goes to this meat shop he's seemingly never been to before to pick up some traditional Scottish meat to bring to his mom to family dinner that night. This is where he meets, but isn't introduced officially to, his gonna be wife, but he doesn't know it yet. I just have to know, Mike Myers is so fucking adorable. I love his hair. I love his 90s-ness. I love his humor. He's so endearing that he's adorable to me. But anyways, it's a quick scene. He gets his meat, notices that the meat lady's hot, and goes on his way. Later that day at his parents' house, we get this shot of his dad singing and dusting his Scottish Wall of Fame. Said before, Mike Myers, he also plays his dad, Stuart. Listen, his dad is basically another version of Fat Bastard. We see his mom and dad dancing, and they're being totally weird and in love. Beyonce's Crazy in Love should have been Weird in Love, because fuck, they are cute. Tony's already there when Charlie shows up. They're basically like brothers. They're just so intertwined into one another's lives that they might as well be Italian and Scottish brothers. And I feel like that's very representative of the melting pot of San Francisco, which is just another fact that I'm realizing in this moment. But anyways, Charlie gives his mom this traditional Scottish meat. She thanks him, but then is like, I don't even like this. Do you? And he goes, yeah, no, I don't like this either. It's disgusting. So why the fuck did he buy it? I think he bought it in his weird way. He was like, oh, let me go find this traditional Scottish meat. What is it called? Haggle? I'm forgetting how to say it, so I don't want to say it because I feel self-conscious. But he just broke up with another girlfriend, right? And his mom is expecting him to bring this woman to dinner, but he's not because he broke up with her. And he's constantly breaking up with women for weird reasons, like smelling like soup. And she really liked this one, the woman he was dating and just broke up with. But the meat didn't soften the blow. Totally weird choice, but okay. Y'all, I love the scenes with his parents. It is fucking hilarious. Like I already said, but I'm gonna keep talking about it. His dad has to be related to Fat Bastard. Basically, I'm convinced this This movie should have had some sort of crossover with Austin Powers. Maybe Fat Bastard is the crossover. And Charlie's younger brother grows up to be Fat Bastard because his dad treated him like shite. Which he does. His dad, just roll the clip. Just roll the fucking clip.
Look at the size of that boy's head.
Shh.
I'm not kidding. It's like an orange on a toothpick.
Shh, you gotta give the boy a complex.
Well, that's a huge noggin. It's a virtual planetoid. Shh. Has its own weather system. Shh. Head, move!
Yeah. Do you see what I'm talking about now? Also, this scene, the actor that plays Tony, I'm fucking forgetting his name now, even though I just told you guys. The laugh is him breaking character in this scene because Mike Myers is just so fucking funny. And I couldn't find anything whether this scene is totally scripted, somewhat improvised, loosely scripted. So I'm not sure if every take was a little different. But regardless, the actor who plays Tony, he had a hard time holding the laugh in. It's a genuine break in character.
Heed! Paper, no! Move that melon of yours and get the paper if you can. Hauling that gargantuan cranium about. I'm not kidding, that boy's head's like Sputnik. Spherical, but quite pointy in parts.
Well, that was offside, wasn't it? He'll be crying himself to sleep tonight on his huge pillow.
In the kitchen, Charlie's mom is telling him about this new thing she's trying, a Garth Brooks juice diet. Listen, I need to know more. What does that entail? Was it real? I should have looked it up, and I did put in my notes, look up, but I miss things sometimes, so I didn't get to that part. But if anyone wants to look it up, fucking let me know, because did they make this up, or was that a real fucking thing at one point in time? Charlie tells his mom about him and Sherry, that was the name of his now ex-girlfriend, breaking up. She's upset, and he admits that he's terrified of marriage. We don't really learn why, though. However, his mom is really kind about it, which I love. We don't get any of the weird pushy shit about marriage from her or his dad or anyone really in this movie. Then his mom asks him if he's seen the news lately and whips out the World Weekly News, which is basically a gossip rag, unverified news newspaper, to which Charlie says as much. But she's going on about this Mrs. X.
Mrs. X. the honeymoon murderer. She marries men under fake identities, and then she murders them. Now, she's murdered three men already. Look, victim number one was a lounge singer. Victim number two, a Russian martial arts expert.
No.
And she's also killed a plumber named Ralph Elliott. And her whereabouts are unknown.
Charlie isn't impressed. He thinks that she's just, you know, buying into bullshit, which, you know, I can't say I wouldn't do the same thing. But anyways, his dad at this point definitely seems to be hammered. And maybe he's been hammered this whole time, but definitely seems to be.
You're in my eyes, you're in my dreams. You are my eyes, you are my dreams. You're in my eyes, you're Celtic. United on me, I decided you're the best thing that's happened to me. Yeah,
the way he rags on his son and his giant head is funny, but also fucking mean, which is also, I'm like, this is the origin of his villain story. Me being the neurodivergent human I am, anything said to me like that at that age, I mean, fuck, even now, but not as bad or as much, I can kind of work through it better, I think. I would have taken it to heart instantly and believed it about myself and held a fuck ton of shame over. Anyways, Tony and Charlie are leaving. Charlie's mom kisses Tony goodnight, but she's more so fucking making out with him against his will. This joke is gross. This isn't funny. I love this movie. I truly adore it. But this whole bit about Charlie's mom trying to get at Tony sexually, and he is, first of all, she's married, but that's not even the most important part, because Tony doesn't want any of it. She's forcing herself on him. That is not okay. Women, we don't do that either. We don't want guys to do that to us, right? It's not okay for either one of us, all right? We're not doing this. The fuck? Okay, the next day, Charlie is zipping around San Fran in his cute little sports car. But seriously, though, does the bee poet potentially make a lot of money? Because, like, where's he getting his money? He's got this cute-ass little sports car. I don't know if it's a sports car, but it's a cute-ass car. Convertible. He's got a nice apartment. And he just does his beats. He drives by the meat shop again and sees Meat Woman in some ridiculous costume as she's kind of opening shop. And she's in some ridiculous costume. Like, maybe some sort of, like, Dutch milkmaid. I don't know. But next, we skip on over to Tony, who, again, he's a cop, and he's at the precinct. He's kind of moping because he isn't sure if he likes his job, but a dude is pondering this because he wanted his experience on the job as a cop boy to be more like a fucking movie than real life. His Bosk? His boss, Alan Arkin, he's not credited for his role, at least in the original credits of the movie, which is weird. I don't know why. But anyways, his boss is asking him what's up. And basically, Tony tells him that he's too nice of a boss. And he also wants to jump from roofs, chasing bad guys, cops and robbers style. And he wants his boss to yell at him more. And he wants the movie version of what he thinks a cop should.
Tony, I don't want to intrude, but you seem a little down.
Well, Captain, it's about my job. I'm having doubts about being a cop. You know, it's not like how it is on TV. And all I do all day is I fill out forms and paperwork. I mean, this is what I do.
It's a point well taken, Tony, but you must understand, although it's not exciting, it's a very important part of our work.
Yeah, but in all my times as a cop, I've never like chased a guy across a crowded city square. I've never hung on to that part of the helicopter. You know that part underneath the thing where it lands? Do you know that part?
Yes, I know that part.
I've never hung on to that. I've never even commandeered a vehicle.
Now that sounds like a lot of fun.
And that's the other thing. You're too nice.
So Charlie goes back to the meat shop to flirt with hot meat lady. It's busy as fuck. This is the scene where we get the interaction with Nalbandian. It's busy as fuck. I think I already said that, but I said it again. There's Nalbandian, who's real serious about getting his one cut of steak.
Can I suggest you?
Sure.
Do you actually like haggis?
No, I think it's repellent in every way. In fact, I think most Scottish cuisine is based on a dare.
I'm next.
You're next.
I'm next.
You're next. Okay. I'm next. Can I help you? Yes.
I'll tell you how you're doing. All I want is one New York strip steak, a quarter inch steak. That's all I want. No more, no less.
Meat Lady Harriet, she seems to reciprocate the flirt. Charlie's Le Flirt, but she's busy and the place is packed and she seems to be the only one who works there. So Charlie offers to help because coincidentally, his dad, Stuart, used to be a butcher. And Charlie says he used to help at the shop that his dad worked at when he was younger. So she says yes, and we officially meet Harriet. As he helps, he's a constant joker. It's definitely endearing, gross at times, but endearing. He's making moo sounds as he messes with some cuts of beef. He's talking to it. He pretends he chopped off his hand at one point and asks some browsing customers for help. Okay, but for real, they aren't wearing gloves. Harriet's meaty, bloody apron is just kind of rubbing against fucking everything. And it's a small-ass shop. This shop is a mess. Okay, so when I was reading about the filming of this scene, because it was a real ass butcher shop, I think it got like hot in there. A lot of the meat went bad because during filming, the sound guy was like, we got to turn off some of this fucking equipment in the shop itself because it's noisy as shit. Also, Nancy Travis, during the filming of one of the butcher scenes, she chopped off the tip of one of her fingers. So that sucks. After they close up, they go get hot dogs, and as they're eating and talking, Dr. Evil shows up.
Well, let's talk about you for a second. Tell me one bad thing that you've done, and it better be evil.
How evil?
Really evil. Like, so evil that you would say it was evil. Like, it's the fruits of the devil. Evil.
Okay, it's just Charlie, but I swear in this moment there is some Dr. Evil a-coming through. Charlie says to her, name one bad thing you've done. Then he says,
how many people have you brutally murdered?
And Harriet says,
brutal is a very subjective word. I mean, what's brutal to one person might be totally reasonable to somebody else.
Okay, damn. She seems a little too serious. And I can't read her at all in this scene. So this is what I'm saying. Nancy Travis did play this role very well, in my opinion. But I also think that Sharon Stone would have brought a little something extra and different, but also good to this role. Harriet makes it real awkward here, but Charlie tries to brush it off and they start walking and chatting. They pass some dudes who are speaking Russian, and we learn that Harriet also speaks Russian because she responds to them. And Charlie, there's some kind of like strange things happening here, but he's also big infatuated with her and he wants to know more. And he's also kind of trying to, I guess, push through his tendency of writing people off for the things that might be weird, nitpicky, stemming from his resistance to commitment. So he forges on, even though there's some kind of like, what the fuck was that, things happening here and there. They go to Harriet's place. It's cool as shit. It's eclectic, exposed brick. Again, very 90s San Fran, what I imagine 90s San Fran to look like. And I love it. It's littered with collectibles. There's a giant poster of Atlantic City, I believe, where Harriet used to live. Charlie is asking after some stuff on the wall, like the Atlantic City poster. And then we also learn here that Harriet is schooled in the martial arts a bit. Charlie's smitten. He gets all serious for a moment, thinking that maybe he should leave because he knows he wants to sleep with her, but he doesn't want to put any pressure on her or screw things up. But listen, Harriet is down for the dirty. So Harriet talks in her sleep.
Yeah. Ralph! Oh, I will. Okay, wait,
She kind of sleepily explains that Ralph is a woman, which seems to kind of appease Charlie's concern here after hearing her cry out Ralph in her sleep after fooking him. The next morning, he wakes up and he goes looking for Harriet because she's not in bed. And he sees that there's someone in the shower, which has this super 80s, 90s frosted glass brick wall built into it that overlooks the main floor of the apartment. So he thinks it's Harriet. So he races up the stairs into the bathroom in his shirt and his tidy whitey undies.
Ah! I'm sorry! I thought you were somebody else! Sorry!
Is not Harriet. No, it wasn't Harriet. Meet Rose, Harriet's sister, who happens to live with her, and Harriet didn't think to mention it before. Harriet did leave a note, but this scene is so fucking awkward. Harriet did leave a note, but I think Rose read and took it.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm Harriet's friend, Charlie.
And, you must be Ralph?
I'm Harriet's sister, Rose. Harriet gave me a note to give to you.
Oh, great.
Dear Charlie, I didn't want to wake you. Make yourself at home. And thanks for the hot dog, Harriet.
Well, that's a very nice note.
He does try to leave, but Rose insists that he stay for breakfast. She's like, I want to make you pancakes and eggs and bacon and fresh squeezed juice, which turns out to just be Fruit Loops. So again, this scene is so fucking awkward. The Ralph thing comes up and Rose is elusive. She's like, oh yeah, I know Ralph. But she doesn't go into any more detail. She's talking like he knows so much more than he actually does, even though he's like, I just fucking met Harriet. I don't know any of this. I don't know Ralph. I don't know her life. Help me out here, Rose. And Rose is not. She's not. She's just sitting there sketching as this is happening. So in the next scene, Charlie is telling Tony about Harriet. And this is where they are heading to Alcatraz, which is cool. But I don't know. This scene also kind of felt odd in a way. Like they were just trying to find a way to put Alcatraz into the film, which Alcatraz is very infamous and iconic in relation to San Francisco. I love to tour it myself someday. It just, I don't really get it. I like it, but I don't get it. This is also where we see Phil Hartman, who is their tour guide.
Hello, everyone. I am a park ranger, and I will be leading you on the tour. All of the park rangers here at Alcatraz were at one time guards, myself included. My name is John Johnson, but everyone here calls me Vicky. Will you please follow me?
I love Vicky. He's great.
He's the best.
Oh.
They talk about Harriet as they tour. Also, one of their dudes in their tour group looks a lot like one of the brothers, I believe, from Home Improvement. I couldn't find anything else on this. I did my best to give it a goog. I'm not always the best with coming up with the concise enough search term to find what I need. As we know, I love words, but I do struggle with having too many words sometimes. I don't even think the ages would match up. I don't remember when Home Improvement started, but I don't even think the ages match up. Still, it's uncanny. I don't know. If anyone happens to have some more info on that, I would be real curious because I'm like, what is happening here? They're talking about Harriet. He's filling in Tony a bit about her and his night and all this as they're casually touring fucking Alcatraz. Phil Hartman, our guide, Vicky, he starts telling them about Machine Gun Kelly.
In this particular cell block, Machine Gun Kelly had what we call in the prison system a bitch. And one night, in a jealous rage, Kelly took a makeshift knife, or shiv, and cut out the bitch's eyes.
Hey, you know, another thing about Harriet I love.
And as if this wasn't enough retribution for Kelly, the next day, he and four other inmates took turns pissing into the bitch's ocular cavities.
Is this real? I need to look this up. Who the fuck is Machine Gun Kelly in relation to Alcatraz? Yeah, so this bitch, he is considered one of the most infamous, famous, whatever, gangsters from the Prohibition era. Well, shit. I wanted to go into more on the real George Machine Gun Kelly. So George Kelly is his name. But anyways, I'm going to go off too much on that. So if you want to, again, all of my, like I've said before, all of my references are in the show notes. So I'll put it in there, a little link to some Alcatraz history and specifically George Machine Gun Kelly. If you want to learn about a mobster from the Prohibition era. So next we get flashes of Charlie and Harriet dating, him helping more at the butcher shop. They go on this double date with Tony at a diner, Fog City Diner. I love it. I'd love to go there someday myself. It's cute. Not much happens. And then they walk home in the rain together and we learn that Harriet is going to go to dinner with Charlie at his parents' house the next night. Next night, we're at his parents' house. His mom immediately starts showing Harriet Charlie's baby photos.
Harriet, why don't you come with me? I have wonderful photographs of him when he's a wee baby.
I'd show the picture of Charlie when he shit his pants in Niagara Falls.
Oh, come on, Mom, don't show her the pictures.
Oh, mate, not Charlie. You got pickle up your ass again.
Is that a super mom thing to do, or was that just a movie trope that we all saw and then assumed that it was a real ass mom thing to do? I don't know. So as that's happening, Charlie excuses himself to go to the bathroom, where he finds his mom's World Weekly News thing again with the one with the article on Mrs. X. So he's looking at it and he's paying closer attention to it this time. And he starts clocking the similarities between the murders and Harriet's life. For example, one of the murders was in Atlantic City. Another was a plumber named Ralph. The third is a Russian man who knows martial arts in Miami. So Charlie gets big ass spooked. In the car after dinner, Charlie, he's freaked out, noticeably freaked out, and he's not hiding it well. And he starts probing Harriet with more questions about her past. Charlie then he brings it up with Tony, who tells him he needs therapy.
I think I'm dating Mrs. X. Charlie. Two words. Therapy.
Charlie does convince Tony to help him look a little bit more into Harriet. Into Harriet. Tony does, and he kind of clears her. He says he's nothing to worry about, so Charlie keeps seeing her. They're at Harriet's one night. He's watching a news report on the rise of poisonings as Harriet comes in trying to get him to drink this smoothie she made for him. Apparently, it took her 20 minutes to make. I guess she was juicing some things, peeling some things. I don't fucking know. He's very persistent that he doesn't want it. But she really wants him to drink it, and he ends up backing himself into a closet and shutting the door. But this door frame is just a frame and then all glass. Still, she can still see him. And she's just standing there looking at him like he's a fucking psycho while she's holding this smoothie that, by the way, is way too thin to be a fucking smoothie. Bitch, this is juice. I don't know what she did to the smoothie, but it's not smooth fat anymore. It's liquid. It's straight. It's runny. I don't want a smoothie that's runny as fuck. Who drinks smoothies like that? That's so weird to me. Am I missing what an actual smoothie is? Because to me, it's thicker. And if it's not, bitch, it's juice. So she leaves and slams the door so hard that a mudslide of closet things, way too many things that couldn't have possibly been in this space, but here it is, just comes crashing down on Charlie. Just hides him. He's just... He's become part of the closet now. Also, I kind of wonder if she was getting into this smoothie juicing thing because she had just been at his house with meeting his parents, and his mom in the beginning of the movie was real into this Garth Brooks juice cleanse diet. So I kind of like, I bet his mom was telling her about this and got her kind of interested in it, and she wanted to try it for herself and Charlie as well. So, you know, I bet that's what was going on there. Later that night, they kind of make up in bed. But then she starts talking about all these intrusive thoughts she has that feel random, but most likely they are her way of talking about some of the hidden parts of her life that she can't tell him about.
You know what I like best about you, Charlie? Is I can tell you anything in the world and you don't judge me. Charlie, have you ever stood at the edge of a cliff or a subway platform with someone and you thought just for a split second, what if I push
you? No, not really. Usually I follow the Judeo-Christian ethic of thou shalt not kill, but that's just me.
I know. I'm just making a point of how many times we trust other people with our lives. I mean, look at us, look at us. We're sleeping. And look how vulnerable we are. And I could do anything to you in your sleep.
What could you do?
Not anything. You're lying on your side, totally asleep. I could just stick a needle in your...
And it does make her seem scary. But also, I think it's kind of a part of her personality is she says some of these quote-unquote weirder things out loud that are more so or less harmless, but said to a certain person in a certain setting like this could be scary. So soon after this, Charlie does break up with Harriet at the park in front of the Full House location. When did Full House even premiere? So this park is definitely just like a famous, infamous, whatever you want to call it, San Fran spot. But to me, I'm just still stuck in my 90s and my Mary-Kate and Ashley days. I was a huge Mary Kate and Ashley fan. Never really a big fan of Full House. It was a little too nice for me. I don't know if that makes sense, but it was like so far removed from my own experience in life, especially growing up, that I just never really liked Full House. And the reboot, it's not for me. But I loved Mary Kate and Ashley. Anyways, then we get a beat poem about Harriet.
Come on! Whoa, man! Whoa, man! We had love, not just sex. Is she Mrs. X? I had to run for my life.
Charlie, he gets a call from Tony, who tells him that someone has turned themselves in for the murder of Ralph Elliott. Charlie then rushes to see Harriet because he's like, oh, God, all of these worries I had that she was a murderer and Mrs. X was her. Must be wrong because someone was just turned themselves in for this. And whether there's any actually proof besides their word seems to matter not to him. So he rushes back to Harriet. He shows up at her place, knocks on the door. She doesn't really want to talk to him. He's telling her that he made a mistake. He freaked out because he loves her. And she admits that she loves him too, but it's too late. And she shuts the door in his face. So what does Charlie do? Yes. Yes, that is correct, dear listener, dear creatures. He does a beat poem.
Harriet! Harriet! Hard-hearted harbinger of haggis. Beautiful, bemused, bellicose butcher. Untrusting. Unknowing. Unlove. Ed. He wants you back, he screams into the night air like a fireman going to a window that has no fire. Accept the passion of his heart. I am lonely. It's really hard. This poem sucks.
He's on the roof outside of one of her apartment windows, the kind you could easily and safely walk out onto. And he has his whole beat poet set up from the bar, the guys with the instruments and all. And she takes him back. I do love that she initially shut the door in his face because he jumped ship when he got scared and she was like, I'm not going to put up with that. She does also take him back pretty quickly. But you know what? She loves him. And she stood her ground for a little bit. So, you know what? I'm proud of that. Harriet goes with him to his parents' 30th wedding anniversary at a place called Cock of the North. I don't know why this tickles me so much. But I love that it's called Cock of the North. This whole scene is cute. I do love his parents. They're kind of wild, unruly-ish human beings, especially in their love and adoration for one another. And I mean, they birthed Fat Bastard in my world, so. Charlie ends up proposing to Harriet.
Harriet. Marry me.
It's spur of the moment, but he means it. Harriet says,
no.
But counter proposes with,
why don't we just live together? We could just live together at first, and let's just live together.
However, after Charlie's dad makes a toast to his son.
Everyone, shut your cake hole! I'm late to make a toast to my son, Charlie. Thank you for throwing us this great party. And I hope you have the same great 30 years that we've had. To Charlie!
She says yes. So they get married. And when it comes time to exchange vows, they're at the pulpit of love. I hated that, but I said it. Here we are. They're saying their vows. He says his vows. He's so fucking excited, which is a huge flip from his commitment issues to fuck yeah, marry me. They're also in Scottish garb, so they have kilts on, which I love a man in a kilt, okay? I like it. More men do it, you know? While being culturally sensitive to the traditional garb. Anyways, when it comes time to exchange vows, Harriet looks terrified. She's hesitating, all bug-eyed, like, what am I doing? And for a moment, in this moment, her sister Rose, who is behind her, also in traditional Scottish garb, which I thought was interesting. Rose looks wild-eyed and scary, waiting for her sister to say yes. They get married. Harriet does say yes. And at the reception, Charlie's dad has a song to sing.
If you think I'm sexy, you want, my body, all you got to do is come. If you want my body, you think I'm sick, come to me and let me know.
Meanwhile, his mom is fucking assaulting Tony again with her mouth and grabbing his ass as he's trying to get away. Just real quick again, don't do this. Everybody to everyone, don't fucking do this. Also, don't make it into a joke because it's not fucking funny. Anyways, then Harriet takes the mic and sings Charlie a song.
And thrill me like you do. And fill my heart with love for only you.
Yeah, I really can't tell if he loves it or he's terrified, you know, to be honest. They head off on their honeymoon at a place Charlie says many famous bit poets have stayed. They're cruising down or up the coast. I don't have a compass. And we jump back to Tony, who's at the precinct in his office, door shut, when his boss kicks open the door.
Yes, Captain.
Don't yes, Captain, me!
Stay out of this. This is strictly homicide.
But Captain, I got this friend.
Right? We all got these friends. I'm warning you, Giardino. Back off, Italian boy. Keep away from this one. It's too big for you.
Wait a minute, Captain. Wait a minute. Trust me on this one. I know what I'm talking about. What's the news?
Oh, you want to hear the news? Well, here's the news. It seems that the old lady that confessed to the murder of Ralph Elliott has also confessed to a couple of other murders.
I knew she would.
Right. Well, she's confessed to the murders of Abraham Lincoln, Warren G. Harding, and Julius Caesar. She's a nutcase. A nutcase.
Okay, so the lady who confessed to the murder of Ralph Elliott turned out to be mentally unwell, which they figured out when she started confessing to other murders like Abraham Lincoln, which is not possible. Like, it's just not fucking possible. Okay, all right. Tony rushes off to warn Charlie, but not before he comes back and tells his boss.
Good for you. That was so much better.
Yeah, you like
really
it?
Really terrific. It was fantastic.
I don't know, the beginning felt pretty good.
Yeah, it was great.
Really terrific. Good job. Keep working on it. You're doing better. It's better than last time. But hell yeah. And I love that his boss, Helen Arkin, is so invested in giving Tony the experience he wants as his captain. I do love this bit between them. It's I know I use the word endearing a lot, but it's one of my favorite words. It's endearing. Charlie and Harriet arrive at Poets Corner, their honeymoon location. They check in. The desk dude warns them that a storm is coming and to be prepared for the power to props go out. Harriet seems out of sorts. She seems worried. There's something bothering her. Paranoid? Scared? I don't know. We're going to find out. They stay in the Robbie Burns room. So I looked this up. I remembered. Robert Burns, he's also familiarly known as Rabbi Burns, spelled R-A-B-B-I-E. So to me, I just want to say it in like a Queens accent. Rabbi. But that's not even Queens. When I try to just make myself conjure the accent without having heard it or it coming out just fluidly, I can't fucking do it. But anyways, he was a Scottish poet and lyricist. He's widely regarded as the national poet of Scotland and is celebrated worldwide. That's who that is. And I just had to fill you in because I was curious as well. So Tony's making some calls to people who knew the three victims of Mrs. X and confirms with each of these people he's gathering information from that the victims did know were in fact married to someone who looked exactly like Harriet. Tony is trying to call through the hotel, but the storm has hit and he can't get through and he's freaking out. So he's going to charter a fucking plane to get to Charlie, because again, they're like brothers. He's not going to just hope for the best here. This is also his opportunity to be the cop he sees in movies. So bitch is taking it. In their hotel room, we see Harriet in the bathroom pulling out a chain with three rings strung from it. What looks to be wedding rings. I wrote in the sound effect in my notes. Dun dun dun. Hopefully I can find the sound effect. Otherwise, you're just getting it from my mouth. Dun dun dun. Tony charters a tiny plane flown by the most not a pilot person ever to fly a plane to get to Charlie before it's too late.
Hey, listen. How long is it going to take you to get there?
Shouldn't take very long. Actually, I have no concept of time.
Geez, is this dangerous?
No. Well, you know, there's chance in everything.
Look, I don't want to get too personal or anything. We've done this before, right?
Oh, yeah. I do this all the time. I've never done it at night.
Charlie and Harriet head to dinner, still in their hotel. Charlie, at one point during this, their meal, he gets up to use the bathroom and Harriet follows him. It's odd as hell the way she follows him without him knowing and is just keeping an eye on him. And you can't, you're definitely suspicious. There's something else here we don't know yet. Meanwhile, Tony's pilot, he's fallen asleep at the wheel.
What are you doing? Wake up!
Oh, man, I was having an amazing dream.
I don't care about your dream. Land the plane!
I mean, that's definitely something you don't want a guy flying a small-ass plane in a storm to do. So, but Tony does make it. They land their plane wherever, and he finally gets through to the hotel. A waiter brings Charlie the phone to his table at dinner with Harriet, and Tony is essentially screaming at him. Harriet looks concerned as fuck, and then the power trips and goes out, and the phone line cuts. And Harriet, she is trying to ask who was it, what's up, what's happening, and Charlie doesn't want to tell her who's now, he's now terrified, but he's trying to not let on that anything's wrong. He does not accomplish this well, but he's trying. Now, Tony tries to commandeer a car from the dad from Beethoven.
Excuse me, sir. I'm with the San Francisco Police Department. This is official police business. I would like to commandeer this vehicle.
No.
What do you mean, no?
I happen to know for a fact that you don't have the right to commandeer my vehicle.
Please, can I commandeer this vehicle?
No.
You're just not going to bend on this commandeering thing, are you?
No.
Okay, so when I was trying to type my notes out, side note real quick, here we go. When I was trying to type my notes out, I couldn't remember how to spell Beethoven. And it came out Beethoven. Beethoven. It sounds like some drug you probably shouldn't be taking. Anyways, I just had to share that with you guys. At the hotel again, the power, it keeps going in and out, right, during the storm. And the staff apparently doesn't care about the storm and has a hard-on for celebrating newlyweds.
Hey, this couple's had middle of this crowd for one night. They got more important things to do, huh? Moving to the honeymoon chair.
So they get the newlyweds, our couple, Charlie and Harriet, into the honeymoon chair, which is basically one of those giant wicker chairs that kind of looks like a throne. They cart them off. The whole staff carries this fucking chair with both of them sitting into it up the hall as much as they can to their room. Because they're like, honeymooners have more important things to do than dine. So sex. They mean sex. Charlie's sweating fucking bullets of fear. Harriet looks scary and insanely concerned and worried and weird in a, not weird, but whatever, in a creepy way as they're sitting in this chair next to each other. Charlie doesn't want to go back to the hotel room. He doesn't want to be alone with her. Man's is terrified. Balls are in a knot. Scared, just escaping back up into his body for protection. Charlie tries to get the bellboy to stay for a drink, a nightcap, in an attempt to not be alone with Harriet.
Hey, why don't you stay for a nightcap?
No, you two want to be alone.
No, really, really. Stay for a nightcap.
Sir, I really don't think I should.
Stay for a nightcap! Oh!
The bellboy just ends up running away like, ah, leave me alone. Anyways, finally, Charlie is alone in the room with Harriet, who immediately starts confessing as there's the storm happening. And again, the power keeps flashing in and out as there's lightning and shit. She starts to confess that she's been married before, and Charlie says that he knows. And she's like, yeah, no, you knew? And he's losing his shit, and he picks up an axe? Listen, I'm assuming this axe was in there because someone was chopping wood for the fireplace in there, but isn't that something you do outside? So you're just leaving axes laying about for anyone to axe things with. They're squabbling, kind of tumbling on the around the room as she wants to explain, but he doesn't want to listen. He doesn't want to hear it because he thinks he knows exactly what's up. The power is now out, like it's just out. Okay. And somehow Charlie gets Harriet locked in a closet, the kind with the slats for a door so you can kind of open and close them, see through them a little bit, you know. He goes to the phone to call for help, or maybe call Tony, I don't know. And he finds a note that he is supposed to have written.
Hello? 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 Dear Harriet, I just can't handle the commitment. It's too hard. I'm leaving you. Love, Charlie? I didn't write this.
Rose, Harriet's sister, attacks. Yes, so our murderer is Rose.
You took her away from me, Charlie! Like all the rest! I have had it!
You are going to die.
She feels like when Harriet gets married, these men are stealing Harriet from her as if she belongs to her. Listen, not one human being belongs to another human being ever. When we have children, we are responsible for the well-being and the upbringing of those children. They do not belong to you. You don't have ownership of them. Do you hear what I'm saying? Anyways, so Rose, you're a bitch. Your sister don't fucking belong to you. She's not your property. All right? Rose has the axe and he's trying to kill Charlie. Meanwhile, Tony makes it to the hotel. Beethoven's dad drove him. I love that, what's his face? I'm forgetting the actor's name. This was his cameo. This was his cameo. Because it's just, he's so dry and hilarious. And he's just like, you're not taking my fucking car. And I guess I'm going to drive you here. And Tony is even like, so if I need to arrest someone, can you just chill and wait here? And he goes, no. And he just drives away. Okay, so like I said, Rose has the axe and she's trying to kill Charlie. He goes out a window onto the roof. There's nowhere else to escape. Because she acts, the axe lady, Rose Axe. Axel Rose.
Welcome to the jungle. We got fun and games.
Axe Rose. She's blocking his exit from the room. Harriet's still locked in the closet. The room is on the top floor of this old ass hotel, our Californian mansion. Okay, so there's nowhere for him to go but the roof into the storm. Tony breaks into the room by kicking the door open. His guns at his side. He finds Harriet in the closet and he shoots it open. She's trying to tell him what's up, but he is just so zoned in on arresting her and that she is the murderer. He's not even like concerned about actually seeing Charlie himself to verify that he's okay. He's just like, oh, I've found her. I arrested her. So we're good now. He's not listening to her. He gets all aggro. He shoots the gun 3 times into the ceiling while he's trying to detain her because she's struggling to like get away from him and get him to listen. But he ends up shooting through the roof right where Charlie happens to be standing, scaring the absolute fuck out of him as he's being chased by axe-wielding Axe Rose. Now in the full dark, on the roof, in a storm, he loses his balance, and now he's hanging off the roof as Rose is trying to axe his hands off, okay? She keeps swinging from one hand to the next, so he's like swinging and just hanging there from one hand, swinging to the other as she's landing the axe into the roof, into the gutter. Mad and wild with rage and murder. Tony, this bitch, somehow isn't registering the sounds from the roof. They're literally right there. And Harriet's like, how the fuck are you not hearing this? And how the fuck are you not paying attention to it, Tony? You're the worst cop ever. Tony, he's just sitting there questioning her, trying to have a conversation with her, seemingly just unable to hear the axe on the roof, lighting up a cigarette. Harriet is still trying to get him to believe her that Charlie's on the roof in active fucking danger, trying to be murdered by her sister.
So what you're saying to me is that Rose killed your husband, forged breakup notes to make you think that they left you.
Yes, yes, yes. Listen, that's them up on the roof. They're up on the roof. Listen!
Oh, you just don't get it, do you? We can talk about this here. And we can talk about it downtown.
Tony, you're a putz. Or, as my dearly departed papa loved to call people, Tony's a turkey. The axe gets stuck in the roof long enough for Charlie to somehow swing himself back up onto the roof because apparently skinny little Macamyers has the strength of 1,000 men. And after having just been hanging from this roof, swinging his balance from one hand to the other as Axe Rose is Axel Rosing him, he gets back up onto the roof. He runs up one side of the roof trying to go to shimmy down the other. When Rose gets the axe free, yells after him, and then just fucking throws this fucking axe at him. And it lands right at the top of the roof where he's about to just slide down the other side, right in front of him as if it's going to hit his landed his fucking face. It doesn't. But it startles and scares him so much that he just ends up sliding down the other side of the roof. He loses his balance and he slides down the other side of the roof, deballing himself by impaling his man, Nuts and Twig, on a ventilation pipe. I'm not calling that by its correct term, I'm sure. But, you know, the pipe where the steam comes out of. Tony has now taken Harriet out front. So they're on the bottom floor, still in cuffs, still trying to arrest her. As more cops are showing up, she's screaming for Charlie, who crawls over to peer over the edge of the roof to yell back down at her with his wound and balls and all. And then Rose comes up from behind him with the axe again. She makes one more attempt to axe his face, but he catches it. So now they're kind of both wrestling over this fucking axe as it's right in his face, the blade. And she ends up kicking him in the nuts. He's already lost them. So now it's just into the taint. But she ends up losing her balance and tumbles off the edge of the roof. And Charlie, he catches her by the hand. So he's holding on to her from completely falling to the ground from off of this tall ass fucking roof by one hand. Rose is now losing her shit. Tony, he gets up there real fast also, by the way. But he ends up grabbing hold of Rose through a window and Rose is arrested. And then Charlie writes a beat poem about it.
Rose, jailbird, happy in her cage, no longer full of rage, she roosts. Harriet, sweet Harriet, you acted cuckoo because you thought I would leave you, sweet bird. Sweet Harriet, so knowing, so trusting, so love, Ed.
The end. They live happily ever after in San Fran in 9 to 3, I guess. Y'all, I really love this movie. You gotta watch it. With all of my episodes, I highly encourage you to actually watch the movie if you haven't seen it. But this one is so fun. In my opinion as a viewer, I think it was done so fucking well. I loved all the cameos. I do love the characters. Mike Myers is brilliant per usual. I know I went off on kind of wishing that Sharon Stone had been cast in the role that Nancy Travis played, but Nancy Travis did do a fantastic job. The whole thing to me is just comedic gold. And again, even if you just watch it to see San Fran in 93 in all its glory, you can't lose with that. My dudes, thank you for listening. Thanks for being here. I appreciate you guys, my creatures. Listen, after my last episode, Lake Placid, when I ended up getting real happy about the term, phrase, whatever, creature feature, I might just continue to call my listeners creatures. You know, I want to be a creature too, so we can just be these creatures together. I adore you, all three of you, because, you know, I don't think I have a heavy listenership, but I appreciate every single one of you. Thanks for sticking around. Don't forget to give the show a follow, a little like, whatever the fuck it's called, so you can get an alert when my next episode is available. I am quite sure of the movie I'm doing next. We're going to do some practical magic. Sandra Bullock, Nicole Kidman, practical magic up in this bitch. I love that movie. And after that, we might do Clue. I feel like I'm starting to veer away from my original intent to do movies that I have these big old trauma bonds with. But this time of year, there are just some movies that I have this big nostalgia towards that are just fun to revisit and are movies that I haven't had as hard of a time revisiting and continuing to love as I do with some other movies. So it feels good to just kind of be having some fun with this for a while. But, you know, it's also my fucking podcast and I'll do what I want with it. It's my podcast and I'll pod what I want to. Pod what I want to. I don't. I like it, but I don't. That was cringy. I do love me some cringe. I'm a cringer creatures. All right, all right, all right. Matthew came back at the end. Matthew, go away. I'm just kidding. I love Matthew McConaughey. Now I'm just rambling. Okay, bye. Bye.
Oh, I hated the Colonel with his wee beady eyes.
and that smug look on his face. Oh, you're gonna buy my chicken. Oh.
Dad, how can you hate the Colonel?
Because he puts an addictive chemical in his chicken that makes you crave it fortnightly, smart arse.
All right, man. Good hanging with you.
Thank you.